all persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention if the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We'll hear argument first in the case of Beeman against Marshall and Hislop. Mr. Coe.
May it please the court. My name is Rocky L. Coe, single practitioner from Coe Law Offices in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. The appellant, Alex F. Beeman, also is present today. We are here today because the plaintiff, Alex F. Beeman, appeals from a grant of summary judgment, which must be reviewed de novo by this court. Beeman had filed charges that he has been discriminated against regarding his working conditions, including being demoted, having a glass ceiling put on his career to resegregate an all-white management staff, and retaliated against for seeking equality in violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Beeman submits that the district court, in granting summary judgment, erroneously made credibility resolutions regarding genuine issues of material fact and failed to properly view facts in a light most favorable to Beeman regarding Vice President and Chief Operating Officer Paul Ewig's lies, deception, concealment, and admitted refusal to mentor, respond to Beeman's accomplishments and qualifications while employed at M&I. More importantly, the foundation and merits of the case in the first six charges, including a March 31, 1999 demotion, were not considered.
Well, they're outside the time limit. Isn't that the problem?
Well, that is the issue before that we are presenting before the court. That is what we will be discussing. We're stating that the statute of limitations should be excused and it should be told because there was no reasonable basis or no reasonable evidence to cause Mr. Beeman to file a charge, and that these as I stated earlier, the facts were concealed from Mr. Beeman, and he was lied to regarding the direction his career was taking. And there's case law which said under these circumstances, the statute of limitations will not run.
It sounds like you're arguing that the statute of limitations doesn't begin until the employer confesses.
No, I'm not. That's I'm not making that argument.
Law.
That argument is not being made. The district court refused to excuse the toll of the statute of limitations, opining.
Tolling of the statute is for extraordinary cases. This seems to be a perfectly ordinary case where there's a dispute between the parties about inferences to be drawn. Mm-hmm. And in those cases, statute runs in a normal way.
Well, I believe that it is extraordinary here from the standpoint that there were no facts, no issues regarding Mr. Beeman's being demoted in March 31st, 1999, regarding his career. If, in fact, he had filed simply because the person who replaced him was a white male, then what would happen is that there would be a proliferation of charges of those kind of cases without any evidence to support the motivation of his being demoted.
The court refers to them as discrete acts that are identifiable at a certain point in time.
Yes.
And that begins the time for that particular act.
Yes, that would be the Morgan case, Your Honor. But also at footnote 7 of the Morgan case, it talks about when a person should have reasonably known or of the injury, or when the person reasonably should have known that the injury was causing this person harm. And that is at footnote 7.
And there's no doubt about that in this case.
Well, I disagree.
Knew exactly what had happened to him.
I believe he was demoted, but in terms of talking about exactly what happened to this person, the motivation is absent.
But what happened is what the Supreme Court is talking about. You have to know your injury before the time begins. But there's no doubt that your client knew his injury.
We do not dispute that. What we are suggesting is, and what we are contending, is that the motivation behind the injury was not present. Equally important is the fact that there is evidence supporting Beeman's contention that Mr. Ewig, with hostility totally unrelated to Beeman's performance, secretly schemed to keep Beeman out of management and put a glass ceiling on his career to maintain segregation in management. This inherently raises credibility issues as to when Beeman should have learned of the breadth and depth of any scheme. Thus, it is Beeman's contention that the plot issue was one for the trier of fact and improper for summary judgment. Indeed, Beeman should have his day in court because not until his discovery of a Burmaster Flack report in the spring of 2000 and discovery did Beeman learn that two high-ranking officials of M&I, President Jeff Williams and COO Paul Ewig, by their mere observance of their historical first African-American in management, sitting among the otherwise all-white managers, felt that he was unqualified, given his job prematurely, questioned his intelligence, considered him as not assistant vice president material, believed he had been given his management job and not earned his way, and he should take severance and leave the company. Remarkably, these two officials made these assessments even though they had never worked with or supervised Beeman. Therefore, their limited visual observance by two high-ranking officials could only be an observation of Beeman's skin color. Moreover, M&I officials knew by a December 1999 Burmaster Flack report that Beeman had far outperformed his white counterpart, Cashin. In fact, Cashin's performance, kept secret from Beeman, was a disaster. Also kept secret from Beeman was the fact that Paul Ewig, in the year 1999, had refused to allow Beeman to come back into management at the request of Cashin to assist him because Paul Ewig, without any evidence, felt that Beeman was unqualified. However, even though Cashin's performance was a disaster, he was not disciplined, demoted. Rather, he was mentored, given a raise, better benefits, and promoted. Beeman had contended that his March 31st, 1999 demotion out of management was facially legitimate because at the time of Beeman's demotion, M&I was concerned about customer complaints called on-tracks and losses and wanted immediate improvement in several areas. Beeman, being a first-time supervisor, had no one to tell him if his performance had been good enough to avoid the high rate of turnover of four supervisors in 8 years, or to avoid being included in the mass reorganization by Ewig, which also removed several white people from management. Although Beeman's recommendations for department improvement had been rejected and there was customer complaints, there had been no overt or covert racial implications. Critical evidence which establishes an ongoing plot by M&I to keep Beeman from the management table but ignored by the district court is that M&I kept hidden from Beeman the on-track customer complaints against Cashin from April 1st, which is the beginning of the day that Beeman was demoted, until January 2000. A motion to compel revealed, and we found out in year 2003, that Beeman had averaged 3 complaints per month and Cashin had averaged a horrendous 136 per month. But this was concealed from Beeman. Thus, the district court improperly and gave deference to M&I's position that Beeman, there also was a secret accusation against Beeman of a $61,000 loss to keep Beeman out of management, and this did not come out until the spring of the year 2000 in Beeman's performance appraisal. The district court.
That loss was, I think, you attributed to someone else.
That is attributed to someone else, Mark Cashin. And in fact,
as the guy you keep bringing up as the one who's worse, right?
Correct. He is the person that replaced Mr. Beeman. However, he was treated differently. He was treated favorably under adverse circumstances to him, while Beeman, who had performed far more adequately, was kept out of management. In fact, the fact that the district court mentioned the $61,000 loss in the decision gives credence to M&I's point that Mr. Beeman was guilty of the $61,000 loss, and there is no evidence of that. It also means that Mr. Beeman had done a poor job. There is no evidence of that. It also means that Beeman had reasonable notice of unwritten discipline. There is no evidence of that. It also gives credence to M&I's position that there was no scheme to keep black people out of management. Discrediting speculation and deference to M&I on a motion for summary judgment is improper. There are two cases, Covington and Payne, which says, out of the Seventh Circuit, which says that the district court must explain why it did not consider all of these factors and discuss them in its decision. Also, there's the Shropshire case, which also states that the M&I, the defendant, should not be allowed to benefit from its scheme.
Counsel, let's assume that we affirm the district court on the statute of limitations issue. Yes. What is left of your claim?
Well, what is left is basically the case is wiped out. One of near the end of my argument, it was going to be the fact that the judge states that there's no similarly situated employee because by stating that Mr. Mike Cashin is not the similarly situated employee as Mr. Beeman, there is no similarly situated employee. So that strikes out, that takes away the animus, the hostility. It says that anything, if in fact what they did was proper at the beginning, it takes away any subsequent improper conduct. But what that in effect leaves, in reality leaves, is the fact that M&I has gotten away with his conduct, and it has depressed Mr. Alex Beeman's career, and because we did not catch it in time, they are allowed to continue their egregious conduct. Very quickly, I believe the briefs adequately state everything else except on the taxing of costs. I wanted to just make one comment that M&I set up an office at the Quarles and Brady offices, and Mr. Beeman was charged for the cost of setting up that office, and I believe that is an abuse of discretion to do that, and at a minimum, those costs should not be taxed to Mr. Beeman. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coe. Ms. Plour.
Good morning. I am Pamela Plour of the law firm of Quarles and Brady, representing the appellee, Marshall and Ilsley Trust Company, referred to as M&I. In my argument today, I'm going to respond to some of the statements made by Mr. Beeman's counsel. In general, I'm going to speak about the proposed findings of fact before the district court, statute of limitations issues, as well as talk a little bit about Mark Cashin. As M&I outlined in its brief, there are specific requirements of the Eastern District of Wisconsin from where this case was venued. As the person opposing summary judgment, Mr. Beeman had an obligation to outline the proposed findings of fact that M&I outlined that he objected to support his objections with citations to specific evidence. And if he did not do so, those proposed findings of fact were deemed admitted. It's M&I's position here that Mr. Beeman did not dispute before the district court the material proposed findings of fact. We're raising this because it appears before the Seventh Circuit. He is making factual arguments to the Seventh Circuit and making evidentiary citations that he never made to the district court. And it's our position that he can't get around his failure to object to the proposed findings of the district court here at the Seventh Circuit. We would direct the court's attention to the supplemental appendix filed by M&I on page 363. What is that document? That document outlines M&I's proposed findings of fact, the response by Mr. Beeman, and the reply by M&I. It says that there are approximately 220 proposed findings of fact, but it turns out there's 221 because of a typo. So what we're talking about here is 221 factual propositions by M&I in support of its motion. Of these 221, in 171 of them, Mr. Beeman adopted them or said, quote, adopts as true or inconsequential, end quote, 171 of those. In another 43, he said, quote, Beeman adopts as true or inconsequential in light of response to number 15, supra, end quote. What does that refer to? Well, also in our supplemental appendix, we have a document that outlines his proposed findings of fact, which essentially are facts that he offered in response to proposed fact 15 of M&I. And that document is on page 329 of the appendix. And essentially what he did was he offered 53 factual propositions with his narrative of what he thought were the facts opposing summary judgment. But if you look at those 53 factual propositions, none of them disputes proposed finding 15. And in fact, in these 43 proposed findings of fact where he said adopts as true or inconsequential, none of those 53 facts creates a dispute of fact, which is, I think, in fact, why the district court said there were no disputes of fact in this case. And the reason is because the district court did not have to scour the record of the 53 proposed factual submissions by the plaintiff to try to figure out where there was a dispute of material fact. Because he did not do that, those facts are also undisputed. So of the 221 proposed findings by M&I, there were 214 of them that he adopted, which leaves us with a handful, 7 proposed findings of fact that he was trying to dispute. 2 of them, proposed findings 58 and 78, he objects, but he doesn't cite any evidence. If you look at the 5 that are remaining, he doesn't dispute them either. For example, there's a proposed finding number 5, which is plaintiff Alex F. Beeman is black. That's the proposed finding. Mr. Beeman's response was he offered 4 paragraphs about Mr. Beeman's married and having some children, but ultimately he didn't dispute it. And that's what he did for the remainder of these proposed findings of fact. So what does this mean? M&I's argument is that these are the facts that frame the appeal before this court. He can't go back and try to dispute facts that he did not dispute before the court. To give you an example of what we're talking about, in his reply brief on page 2, he vehemently denies that the first time he had noticed that M&I was pointing to him as being responsible for what's called this $61,000 Hibernia loss was in April or August of 1999. He goes in his brief and talks about how M&I grossly misstates the record and makes some other arguments and evidence. But if you look at proposed finding of fact 58, which is the fact upon which this is based, it has one sentence. There's a response by Mr. Beeman, but not a single citation to any evidence. It's M&I's position, because he didn't cite any evidence before the district court, it's deemed admitted, and he can't dispute it now by finding what he thinks is evidence in the record to dispute that proposed finding. He doesn't get a second bite at the apple, so to speak. And we urge the court to focus on the proposed findings of fact before the district court, Mr. Beeman's failure to object to those in his submissions and arguments to this court.
Are these findings then to solidify the fact that all of these are outside the 300 days?
All the facts that we relied on in our arguments in our brief, including the statute of limitations arguments, are in the proposed findings. And I'll talk about that a little bit in the statute of limitations argument. We outline what he admitted at his deposition of what he knew about the 6 time-barred claims in the proposed findings of fact. So turning to the statute of limitations argument, as the district court outlined, there were approximately 12 race discrimination claims, and 6 of those are barred by the statute of limitations. There are 2 doctrines that the appellant, Mr. Beeman, has used. The first is equitable estoppel. The second is equitable tolling. Equitable estoppel is rarely ever invoked. It involves, he has to show wrongful conduct by M&I that he justifiably relied on that delayed his filing during the relevant time period. So if you look at any of the times of these 6 actions, the relevant time period is the statute of limitations, which is 300 days under Title VII. So when he refers to his demotion on March 30th of 1990, that starts statute of limitations. He has to show wrongful conduct by M&I in that 300-day period, this concealment, the secrets, the alleged lies that he talks about, that prevented him from filing. And I'll talk a little bit about what he said in his oral argument. He talks about the demotion and that M&I concealed Cashin's performance in 1999. He talks about this Burmeister Flack report that talked about, quote, Cashin's mess, quote. What Beeman is essentially saying is, because I didn't know about what I see as another co-worker's performance, that's concealment by M&I. And our position is, that's not concealment by M&I. Just because you don't know about something doesn't mean that M&I engaged in some affirmative act to mislead you from filing. Under the theory espoused by the appellant, the statute of limitations would never begin to run because there'd be concealment unless when two employees competed for a position, the employer opened the doors to the personnel file for fear of having concealment. The fact of the matter is that nothing that he alleges gets to that level. If you look at, he talks about hiding these ontracts, which are some documents created by M&I that record problems in M&I Trust. That was the subject of a discovery dispute that were turned over in 2003, and the court can look to the record if it wants to know about the discovery dispute, but surely a discovery dispute in 2003 has no bearing on alleged concealment in 1999. He talks about the pay raise cancellation. He says Klomstedt lied in August of 1999 that Beeman did not get a raise because Jors, the former supervisor, wasn't there to do an evaluation. This is the reply brief at 9. There's no evidence in the record of that. None. What there is an undisputed proposed finding of fact that at that time, Klomstedt told Beeman that he did not get an evaluation because Jors was supposed to do it, Jors left, and now there was nobody here who had direct knowledge of his performance during that time. And that's proposed finding 68. Then he talks about not getting an evaluation. He says that Klomstedt apologized for Jors' quote, malfeasance, quote, and then lulled him into not doing anything with a promise of a year-end first-time bonus of 5%. Lulling. In his deposition and in the undisputed proposed findings of fact of M&I, Beeman said that he interpreted Klomstedt's promise of a bonus as a threat to discharge him. And this is proposed finding of fact 71. Now apparently he's trying to characterize it, the discharge, which was a threat, into a lulling since he's trying to show concealment. It's M&I's position for equitable estoppel that none of this rises to the level, which if you look at the Seventh Circuit cases, it involves hiding evidence, doing something affirmatively wrong, promising not to plead an affirmative defense, something like that, to mislead a party, none of which has happened here. Turning to the equitable tolling, the other doctrine, he says that it wasn't until spring of 2000 that a reasonable person could have understood that he had a possible claim. And the two points I want to focus on, based on the Seventh Circuit case law, is could realize there was a possibility of a race claim. That's what the case law talks about. It's an extremely low threshold because unlike filing a court action, to go down and file a race discrimination charge, there's no pre-complaint inquiry. There's no requirement that a good faith investigation occur. That's all he had to do. If we look at his three claims, the demotion on March 30 of 99, the transfer on the date to what's called the SMAC desk, the SMAC desk, and then his transfer to the settlement desk in July of 99, these are all the undisputed facts that are outlined in our motion and in the brief by M&I and the proposed finding. At that time, he knew he was in a grade 18 job. He knew he was supervisor of income processing. He knew he was black. He knew he was replaced by a white man who was taken from another supervisor position. He knew he went into a job that did not require supervision. He knew he was going into a job that involved grade 14 work. He said up until that time, his supervisor had told him that everything was going well in his department. Beeman said that he had so many questions that he went in July of 99 to talk to Wayne Klomstedt. He emailed Wayne Klomstedt on August 26, 1999. All of these facts are certainly sufficient to put a reasonable person in the position that they could possibly realize that they might have a race discrimination claim. Certainty is not required, and that's something that the appellant has talked about, that he didn't know the exact reasons why Ewick did something or the exact reasons why something happened. Certainty is not required, as the district court stated in its opinion, for there is never certainty even after the entry of a judgment. What the case law requires is knowledge of a possibility. Turning to the last three of the claims that are subject to the statute of limitations, canceling of the pay raise in June of 99, not getting a performance review in June of 99, and him saying he didn't get a promotion to the trade coordinator supervisor job in August 1999. Again, he knew in July 99 that he didn't get an annual raise. He knew that he had always gotten an annual raise. He knew in July of 1999 he was due for an evaluation in the previous month. He knew his supervisor quit, and he knew he never got a review in June of 99. By mid-August, he admitted that he knew a white person was selected for the position that he says that he wanted. It's our position that all of these facts are sufficient to put a reasonable person on notice of the possibility of a race discrimination claim. Turning to Mark Cashin, we would refer the court to page 39 of our appellate brief for the brief discussion of Cashin. Cashin comes up a lot in this case. It's MNI's position that Mark Cashin is not relevant. If you look at the demotion claim and put aside all the other arguments of MNI, he's not similarly situated. Because essentially what Beeman is saying is, I was demoted in March of 99 by Scott Jors, who made a recommendation to Paul Ewing. And he's looking into the future to Cashin's assessment by Wayne Klomstad. So what it involves is different supervisors in different time periods under different executive regimes at MNI Trust. Based on the Patterson case talked about in our brief on page 40, where the court said that employees supervised by different supervisors are not similarly situated, we don't think they're similarly situated. Further, perhaps more importantly, the Seventh Circuit held in the Cullen case talked about in our brief that the subsequent poor performance of a replacement is immaterial because obviously it could not motivate the allegedly discriminatory act that occurred months earlier. And in that case, the district court vacated a jury verdict for a plaintiff based upon the district court's entering that evidence into the record. So moving to the other claims where Cashin comes up, Cashin comes up in the 2001 and 2002 evaluation claims, and those are claims that Beeman alleges that the supervisor at his time, a guy named Dave Blader, gave him false evaluations, and then he complains about a 2000 memo from Ewing and Klomstad. And our point is the same, that again, you're talking about he's trying to take assessments of Wayne Klomstad against Mark Cashin. When Cashin's in a different job, Cashin's working in income processing at the time. At the time when Blader is assessing Beeman, Beeman's at the settlement desk. So totally different jobs, different supervisors. It's an apples to oranges comparison that we don't think it's appropriate to look at Cashin repeatedly because he just is not similarly situated to Beeman. Unless there are any questions, we would like to conclude our argument requesting for an affirmance of the district court's opinion granting summary judgment.
Thank you, Ms. Plour. Anything further, Mr. Coe?
Yes, Your Honors. Regarding statement of facts, one was submitted by Beeman, and there are affidavits which have been submitted by Beeman in the record, which disputes and set forth his position. The lies that I was talking about earlier, we want to go into Mr. Beeman's appraisal. We want to go into Mr. Beeman's absence of a raise in 1999. Mr. Beeman did exercise due diligence and went to Mr. Wayne Klomstad and asked what in August of 1999 and asked what had happened to his raise, what had happened to his appraisal. And he was told that he could not get one because Mr. Scott Jors was not there, which was a lie, because Scott Jors had appraised Mr. Beeman as a 3 and had recommended him for a raise. And that is where the $61,000 loss comes into play, because secretly Mr. Beeman was being accused of causing a loss. My time is up. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Coe. The case is taken under advisement. Our next case for argument this morning is Carnes Company.